Despite Irene, the U.S. Open started on schedule today in New York. Novak Djokovic, the men's top seed, Caroline Wozniacki, the top women's, but could either beat John McPhee or Nabokov in the fantastical imaginary tournament called the Intertemporal Tennis Writers Classic, with a narrator calling for clips of writing as a color commentator would replay a forehand slice. The event exists only in an essay written by Touré, writer and cultural analyst for MSNBC, but also someone equally at home on a court. Touré grew up playing tennis at the Dorchester, Massachusetts Sportsman's Tennis Club, founded by the late James Smith and his wife Gloria for inner-city tennis fans. Touré's essay appeared in the New York Times Book Review. We thought it perfect for today and reached him at his Brooklyn home. And Touré, we'd like to start with a reading of your tennis writing. Now, in your essay, it's the narrator reading it. And as the writer of the essay, you knock yourself out in the very first round. But please read a little of your piece that you wrote for Vogue about playing tennis with Jennifer Capriati. Go ahead when you're ready.
The whole incident takes on the feel of intense aerobics mixed with a back alley mugging. And you're just deflecting and defending. And eventually, after 8 or 9 minutes, your arm starts to throb and your lungs start to shriek. And each new shot racing at you is like a punch to the chest. And you feel her inner bully.
And the crowd roars at the writing of Touré.
I mean, it's interesting because there is a narrator who is not me. It's sort of set on the last day of the tournament. The final match has ended, and they're having that sort of announcer's recap of the tournament and the highs and lows of the tournament.
Right.
And the announcer is talking to Johnny Mack, who, you know, may or may not be John McEnroe.
Yeah, may or may not.
A parody of John McEnroe, who's just named Johnny Mack. He's sort of talking at him about, we saw this happen, we saw that happen, everybody was hoping for this great match to come together, and he's sort of explaining what makes it work in this tournament. Because these people are not actually playing tennis against each other, right? They're being judged as tennis writers against each other, and that's how you move forward.
Well, they're not playing tennis, but as you point out, in this tournament, this imaginary tournament, your forehand is your vocabulary. Your backhand is your eye for detail.
Right. Your ability to turn words into poetry and rhythm is your volley. Your use of metaphor and symbolism is your overhead. Your deep understanding of the sport is your first serve. So it doesn't matter your ability to play tennis, except where your ability to play tennis helps you as a tennis writer.
Well, let's take everyone through the tournament. Okay, Torres out. Too bad. But you also knock out a lot of famous writers in the preliminaries. There's Frank DeFord, Barry Hanna, as you write, the incomparable Neil Amdur. Neil Amdur? Really? He's out?
In the quarterfinals?
Yeah.
I mean, the semifinalists are extraordinarily heavy historical figures.
You also knock out the unforgettable Red Smith.
Because one of the great sports journalists of the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah.
But the semifinals consist of John McPhee, who wrote Levels of the Game, Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote incredibly about tennis in Lolita, Martin Amis, who's written fantastic stuff about tennis for The New Yorker, and an amazing little part of an essay he wrote in which he compares Nabokov and James Joyce as tennis players.
Mm.
So, you know, tennis is very important to Martin Amis. His New Yorker pieces on Wimbledon and tennis are always, you know, fantastic. And, of course, David Foster Wallace.
Okay, so this is the setup for the semis. Let's start with John McPhee. As you said, wrote one of the best books on tennis ever, Levels of the Game. It's about the 68 U.S. Open semis in which Arthur Ashe defeated Clark Graebner. Do you have a little taste of that writing?
I do. A person's tennis game begins with his nature and background and comes out through his motor mechanisms and shot patterns and characteristics of play. If he is deliberate, he is a deliberate tennis player. And if he is flamboyant, his game probably is too. A tight, close match, unmarred by error and representative of each player's game at its highest level, will be primarily a psychological struggle. I mean, you know, I think that's just a really beautiful way of putting it and a really interesting way of putting it, that the way we play on the court, perhaps the way you play almost any sport, is an extension of who you are as a person. And there's not necessarily going to be this sort of 180 divide. It's more likely going to be, just a further expression of who you are, really.
But as you write, even though Levels of the Game is an exceptional and timeless work,
it's
a total shock when McPhee, despite writing this great book, loses in the semis to someone who's only done a few pages on tennis, Nabokov.
Yeah, well, what Nabokov writes about Lolita, about tennis, about Lolita playing tennis, it's extraordinary. I mean, you know, in my mind, Nabokov's the greatest novelist of the century. You know, and Lolita is probably the greatest novel of the century.
Well, let's set it up for the listener. This is midway through Lolita, Nabokov's Lolita. Umberto, and Dolores Hayes, his Lolita, traveling cross-country, and they stop to play tennis on courts in a motel. Would you please do a reading for us?
My Lolita had a way of raising her bent left knee at the ample and springy start of the service cycle when they would develop and hang in the sun for a second, a vital web of balance between toed foot, pristine armpit, burnished arm, and far back-flung racket, as she smiled up with gleaming teeth at the small globe suspended so high in the zenith of the powerful and graceful cosmos she had created for the express purpose of falling upon it with a clean, resounding crack of her golden whip. It had, that serve of hers, beauty, directness, youth, a classical purity of trajectory, and was, despite its spanking pace, fairly easy to return, having, as it did, no twist or sting to its long, elegant hop. And, I find it really interesting because it's an amazingly beautiful, microscoped description of her serving, and yet it's this great metaphor for who she is because he, or at least who he sees her as, because he sees her as beautiful, yeah. Right? But she's helpless. She can do nothing to repel him. I mean, she tries, but she's no match, especially now at this part of the novel when her mother is gone and he, you know, is traveling with her and he's had her before and he will have her again. And it's an amazing way of advancing characterization, of advancing the novel a little bit. You know, I mean, this is not a vacation moment in the novel. This is yet another chance to explain who Lolita is through Umber's eyes.
Well, it's also a way of advancing in your imaginary tennis writing championship because Nabokov moves on to the finals against the winner of the Martin Amis-David Foster Wallace match. That's culture commentator Touré. His essay about an imaginary smackdown of tennis writing appeared in the New York Times Book Review. When we come back, who wins? Here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Touré. He's culture commentator for MSNBC, but today we're talking about his essay in the New York Times Book Review called Tennis by the Book. It's about an imaginary competition, the Intertemporal Tennis Writers Classic, with writers lobbing words instead of tennis balls. Touré imagines a color commentator, a narrator, talking about the competition, calling for clips of the writer's work, just as one might call for video of shots. And at this point in our story, Touré, we're down to the semifinals, as we heard before the break. In the first semi, of Vladimir Nabokov beats John McPhee, based on Nabokov's writing about Lolita's tennis playing. The other semi featured Martin Amis against the late David Foster Wallace. But Touré, what happens to poor Martin Amis?
Well, certainly nothing poor about Martin Amis, right? He's a superstar. And in this piece, I use him, Amis, talking about the writing of Nabokov and James Joyce and creating this massive metaphor of them as tennis players. Nabokov, Martin Amis writes, was the more complete player. Joyce seemed to be cruising about on all surfaces at once and maddeningly indulged his trick shots on high pressure points, his drop smash, his side spun half volley lob. Nabokov just went out there and did the business, all listless power and touch. And it's an interesting, amazingly interesting metaphor. And I think that Nabokov has just as many, if not more, trick shots than James Joyce. He's certainly full of them. He certainly has every shot in the book. But, you know, both of them are two of the greatest writers of all time.
By the way, is that where you got this idea, Touré, from Martin Amis, who compares the writing?
Yeah. I don't want to say directly. I mean, I read that piece from Amis 10, 15 years ago, and maybe it stuck somewhere in my craw, and I came out and said, wait a minute, what if we had, you know, what if we
compared everybody's writing
into players based on who they are as writers? Yeah. And but it was really not a direct inspiration.
Well, so a great comparison of tennis and writing from Martin Amis, but still, the British novelist gets steamrolled by the monster of this sport, David Foster Wallace, as you write, with an exclamation after each one of his names, and the late Dave Foster Wallace, of course.
I mean, this is one of the greatest writers of my generation, perhaps the greatest writer of my generation. I'm struggling to think of who would be reasonable competition for him. And the guy could do fiction, and there's a lot of tennis in Infinite Jest. He could do nonfiction. He talks about Federer. He talks in a very brilliant, memorable essay about Michael Joyce, a nothing player, and does so much to explain what the sport is like when you're ranked around 150, 140. There's an awesome essay that Foster Wallace does about himself as a junior player in Illinois. Kind of describes himself as a pusher, but still an effective pusher. A person who's not playing so aggressively, who's getting a lot of net coverage on every shot, sort of lobbing a little bit, so, you know, refusing to miss, and that's hitting a lot of lobs not taking many risks.
Yeah. Well, so David Foster Wallace grew up with the game and wrote that terrific line about the game. Do you have that with you?
Well, this is from David Foster Wallace writing about Roger Federer. Roger Federer is showing that the speed and strength of today's pro game are merely its skeleton, not its flesh. He has figuratively and literally re-embodied men's tennis, and for the first time in years, the game's future is unpredictable. You should have seen on the grounds outside courts the variegated ballet that was this year's Junior Wimbledon. Drop volleys and mixed spins, off-speed serves, gambits planned, three shots ahead, all as well as the standard-issued grunts and booming balls. Whether anything like a nascent Federer was here among these juniors can't be known, of course. Genius is not replicable. Inspiration, though, is contagious and multiform, and even just to see close-up power and aggression made vulnerable to beauty is to feel inspired and, in a fleeting, mortal way, reconciled. I mean, you know, that's just awesome writing, and he's giving you a sense of what it is to be, I think, on the court with these young geniuses who are imitating Federer, and also trying to look into the future of the game, and, you know, avoiding that trap that a lot of people go, he's the next guy. Who knows who the next guy or woman is, but here's how they're going to play, because they're all following this Picasso of the sport.
So David Foster Wallace, you write, is the Federer of writing about the Federer of tennis.
Yeah.
And the other line that I was thinking of when he was young, when he described tennis, what was that line? Billiards?
Yeah, tennis is like billiards with balls that won't hold still. It is chess on the run. It is to artillery and airstrikes what football is to infantry and attrition. That's just fantastic.
Right.
Sort of group of metaphors or analogies. It's sort of a fantastic group of analogies that just sort of link tennis within the sporting pantheon.
Yeah.
You know, the intelligence of it, the angularity of it, the power of it, the finesse of it.
Well, and it makes you wish that there would be, you know, a chance for crowds to roar about it.
I mean, you know, writing is necessarily done alone, which is perhaps why I think a lot of writers understand the impulse to play tennis and write well about it, because tennis is this generally singular thing done largely in quiet. You're only supposed to cheer after the points are over. You're not supposed to cheer so much during the points as in other sports. So much of it happens in the head with one individual trying to work out a problem. And there's not a traditional clock aspect, right? Which is sort of like most writing, you know, you kind of go on until you realize that you're there, and it's not really like, you know, I mean, there is sort of a thing of, especially for magazines, of like, you have till 7, and then we got to have it because the magazine's got to go to bed. Mm. But generally, it's more like, especially with book writing, it's more like, you know, you just work on it until it's like, you know, okay, it's, you know, it's done. How do you really know it's done? Well, you know. You know, as opposed to the clock in basketball,
right,
which is finite and might make the game truly finished before the clock expires. In tennis, 6-love, 5-love is probable, but not safe. I have seen in the junior circuit even that overcome. So, you know, it's never, you know, it's never over until, you know, that's, you know, you've fully finished out that second set.
That's Touré, cultural commentator for MSNBC, but we've been talking about his back page New York Times Book Review essay called Tennis by the Book, his imaginary intertemporal tennis writer's classic. And by the way, the narrator of the recap of this classic is Jim Smith. That's the first person voice you give yourself, the writer, the narrator of all of this. That's, of course, Jim Smith, the adored late founder of your home tennis club, Sportsman's, here in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Touré, by the way, I want to mention your upcoming book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? Can't wait to talk to you about that. Thanks so much.
Thank you.